Yeah, so ostensibly this is the Manchester book launch of our book. And we've done a few, we've done a few sort of talks around the country and abroad actually. using the excuse of a book launch to just to talk about politics basically. Try and get people together to talk about politics. This book is sort of like a collection of like articles or interventions that me and Brian and several other people have written over the last 10 years, and these are sort of like interventions into, well, they're mainly interventions into what was known as the movement of movements, and then things that came out of it like climate justice movement. Like our political histories go back further than that. We've been really, the Free Association is a group of friends who've been involved in politics together for about 20 years. It's a long time, really. Should move on, but so we sort of like we basically got to know each other. We were in an anarchist group called Class War back in the early 1990s. Then we were involved in a move to sort of dissolve Class War, and partly because we wanted to dissolve the organisation that we were involved in, and not because it could no longer operate, but because it could only operate in a way it had always operated. And basically, for us, the organisation, the way of thinking was a barrier to getting involved with what's going on. I just want to sort of bring that up because we think we're in a similar sort of position now as we were perhaps in the late 90s, where a certain sort of like, well, the movement of movements, for instance, is dead. You know, it's lost any sort of grip on the world, and indeed all the movements that have sort of like inherited from that, like climate justice movement, no longer makes sense. It's been a big shift. And so as part of this, when we came to write this book, or collect these articles together, we wanted to write a sort of like a jot, an end, a sort of postscript in a way. In order to sort of work out how like the inheritances of this sort of like movement could now be changed and adjusted to like the new situations. But actually, we're not going to talk about that. We're going to talk about something that's not in the book, but which we think is sort of like apt. So I'm going to hand over to my friend Brian, who will kick it off.
I have to read from a script. My solicitor advised me to do this. I'm going to stick with what they say. I'm not as good at freestyling as Keir is. I'm going to start with a quote from Marx and Engels. Because it's a really interesting quote, I think we can look at that why. In the Communist Manifesto, they say this: modern bourgeois society, by which I think they mean capitalism, is like the sorcerer who is no longer able to control the powers of the netherworld whom he has called up by his spells. Capitalism isn't just greed, although that's how it sometimes appears. It's not reducible to the nefarious plans of individual capitalists or scheming politicians. Although I think we both know that Cameron and Murdoch are cunts.
Very controversial.
No, it's a crowd pleaser, that one.
Can never lose it.
Capitalism isn't even a thing, properly speaking. It's a set of relations. And those relations have a logic that we're all caught up in. I think capitalism operates by summoning up a series of abstract dynamics that magically come to appear as natural and eternal. To borrow a title from a recent book, we could think of this as capitalist sorcery. Sorcery is a pretty strange term to use. We're materialists, not mystics, after all. But I think there's something about sorcery that's appealing. Like the best magic, the reproduction of capitalist social relations seems to happen behind our backs. But when the lights go up and we look around and we look for the wire and the mirrors, there's nothing there. There's no evil magician. It's actually us who's doing the trick all the time. We're caught up in forces that we can't quite get at. As we go about our everyday lives, we go to work, we go to the pub, we go to the shops. We presuppose, for instance, that money will be the basis of our interactions with other people. And because we presuppose that, it seems it's not questioned, but also seems beyond our control. Now, we know that our interactions also contain something in excess of money, in excess of capital, something we could think of as human. But that something human is something we're discouraged from thinking about. It's not important in our relations most of the time. And these dynamics are really, really central to how capitalism works, I think. And they're part of the reason it's survived for so long. Because they're incredibly flexible. They work across a whole range of different forms of social organisation at all scales. You think about a multinational corporation in Tokyo or a workers' co-op in the global south. You couldn't think of two more different social organisations. Yet they'll both operate along the same capitalist dynamics. Those dynamics will still be at work in those organisations. The same with governments in Berlin and Havana, or housing co-ops in Manchester or Leeds. So that's why I think capitalism has been so successful, that flexibility of those dynamics. They're not bothered about the content. But those dynamics have actually been intensified by neoliberalism, which is the phrase that we use to describe the phase of capitalism we've lived through for the last 30-odd years. Under neoliberalism, the market has come to invade ever more areas of our life, areas that were in the past separate from. They were part of something we could control or much closer to us. We're put into situations where we're forced to see other people as competitors. We repeat those behaviours again and again. And as we do that, it becomes harder to work out where capital ends and where we as humans begin. In just the same way as it's harder to work out where our working day finishes and the rest of our lives start. I think something that's really important to remember, this isn't a question of faith. This isn't a question of ideology or belief. We don't need to believe in any of this for these dynamics to be effective. We can despise wage labour and the commodity form as much as we like. We can set up organisations, we can go on marches, we can write books and have public meetings about it. But the patterns of our lives are based on certain assumptions. And those presuppositions inevitably come to appear as permanent, unchanging, outside of history, and more importantly, outside of our control. There's a great line from the Gang of Four, who probably very few of you will know. They're a post-punk band from the late 70s.
A popular beat combo, my love.
There you go. In one of their songs, they say, "Each day seems like a natural fact." And that speaks a lot to me about the way my life's lived. And this, I think, is the paradox of capitalist sorcery. The mechanisms of capital, the way it's reproduced, they're not actually hidden. They're right in front of us, but they're really hard to grasp. And the effects of it are actually totally concrete. You can sometimes touch them, the way they physically limit our lives. I think that's what people mean when they talk about a real abstraction. I think that's what capital is. So something happened a few years ago, the economic crash, the crisis, and that changed an awful lot of things. Not everything, but an awful lot changed. The myths of growth, of progress, the end of history, they're all shattered. The idea that neoliberal globalisation will solve the world's problems has just evaporated. Nobody really believes that anymore. All the neoliberal propaganda about social advancement, inevitable progress, everything basically getting better and better and better, it's fallen to pieces. And that whole project has been exposed as a good old-fashioned mugging. Social wealth has concentrated into an even tiny number of hands over the last 30 years. Every year the Sunday Times do a rich list, which I study. The 1,000 richest people in this country are now worth £400 billion. That's 4% below the figure recorded at the height of the boom, just before the crash. And there's 73 billionaires in this country. 73? That's 20 up, 20 more than last year, and just too short of the all-time high. I think I'm incredibly proud of that. So the problem is, despite its ideological collapse, neoliberalism obviously isn't dead, right? No one believes in it anymore, but like a zombie, it staggers on. If you look at the neoliberal reforms of the public sector, they're actually still being rolled out and being intensified. Just yesterday they announced more areas of the NHS can be put out to the market. Not because anyone believes in it, anyone believes that's the best way to organise it, but A, there's no money left, no public money left, but B, more importantly, there's no other social form of organisation that's been able to acquire the coherence to impose itself against capitalism. The Italian Marxist Antonio Gramsci, he said something really interesting. He said that crisis comes about because the old is dying and the new cannot yet be born. I think that doesn't tell the whole story. I think there's something about the new not yet being strong enough to kill off the old. And so I think we're left in a situation where we've got effectively a death of politics. Neoliberalism staggers on. We reproduce those capitalist social relations every single day. And we accept a topsy-turvy world as natural. There's a really good example of this. Last year, when the government unveiled the cuts, as they were, it's the biggest programme of public spending cuts since the Second World War. The scale of those cuts, if you look at the figures, it's absolutely staggering. Or rather, it was staggering, and now the cuts are just a fact of life. We read about them, we see them on banners, we go on marches about them, but they're something we have to live with. We can argue about the details, we can say they go too far, too fast, but the underlying logic, it's really hard to question. So, if we shut this library, we can keep this one open. Or if we take a pay cut, no one has to lose a job. For centuries, politics was seen as been about the struggle for the good life, how we attain a good life, how we live as humans. All that's gone. Politics now is reduced to the management of scarce resources. I think this is the central problem for me of capitalist sorcery. We can't confront the dynamics of capitalist social relations head on. There isn't some external enemy. Much as I'd like to believe, I'd like to think that Murdoch and Cameron are pulling the strings and if we do away with them. But that's not true, and I think it's not helpful to think like that. I think it's more interesting to think, the way the Invisible Committee put it in their book, to think of capital as a rhythm that imposes itself, a way of dispensing and dispersing reality. Capital organises us in certain ways, and it also disorganises us. But sometimes, we're able to disrupt that rhythm, and sometimes we can get some collective traction on the world. There are times and spaces where we find ourselves with a chance of breaking the historical conditioning that limits the way we can live our lives. These moments might be brief, or they might spread across several years. They might be in a clearly defined area, or they might range across the whole globe. It might involve brief flashpoints or battlegrounds, or they might involve a blossoming of political and cultural spaces. In whatever way they emerge, these moments are part of what we've called moments of excess. Available in all good bookshops. I think there's two things that we experience in moments of excess that are important. The first is rapture, by which I mean a joyful connection with other humans in a way we haven't experienced before. But connected to that, and just as important, is rupture, which is a break with the world as it is, an interruption of that capitalist rhythm. But there's more to rupture than that, I think. By puncturing the normal, by breaking our understanding of what is possible and what's natural, moments of excess also introduce the supernatural. However we think of ourselves, as proletarians, the working class, immaterial labourers, the poor, whatever, we are also part of the powers of the netherworld that Marx was talking about. In these moments of excess, we're also summoning up a different, repotentialized world. A world where many different worlds are possible, as the Zapatistas say. And before I pass over to Keir, I just want to remind ourselves how quickly these moments can explode. Take one example from the so-called Arab Spring at the turn of the year. In Egypt, people took over a public space, Tahrir Square, and they made it their own. From one set of politics, from here, it's quite easy to see that as fairly straightforward, a reclamation of space. It's something people done for centuries. You can think about student occupations, you can think about guerrilla gardening, you can think about squatting. That reclamation of space is an important thing. But I think what happened in Tahrir Square actually goes deeper than that. They held the space, they defended themselves against attacks from the police and from thugs loyal to the state. They built barricades around it. They set up checks for anyone trying to enter the square. They organised a network of tents for people to sleep in. They set up toilets and washing facilities. They rigged up street lamps to provide electricity. They established rubbish collections and medical treatment centres. And what they did what the Parisians did in 1871 and what Wynne Stanley did in 1649. They built a commune, a living, breathing commune. from nothing. At this point, I'm going to pass over to Keir.
Okay, so Tahrir Square seems like a long way away as we sit here in a cold, well, not too cold, Ben, but in a very nice back garden in Manchester. The real question is, you know, really what we're concerned about is, like, what about the UK here and now? You know, what about, how can we sort of ignite something similar to Tahrir Square, perhaps, or something more than Tahrir Square in Manchester in 2011? The problems I think we face is that we seem to be stuck in a sort of double impasse. Like socially, we're in an impasse. The whole of our society is in an impasse. Now, ever since the economic crisis, you know, like we've talked about neoliberalism staggering on like a zombie. But there are no answers being offered for any of the crises that face us at the minute. There's just nobody's been offering any solutions basically. There's a big discussions about trying to do a second bailout of Greece at the moment. If that doesn't happen, it could be the euro could collapse. It could be another crisis. But like that's basically just kicking the can down the road for another sort of like 6 months, because there's no way out. There's no solution as far as business is normal, politics is normal is concerned. That's a real big problem, because we actually do live in society. Even though we would want to smash it, we don't want it to just collapse and leave us. Well, perhaps we do. We'll get into that later. The other impasse on this double impasse is radical anti-capitalist movements are also in an impasse. And we've been in an impasse, well, probably for quite a long time, before the economic crisis. But the economic crisis really brings it out in a couple of ways. Like one way we talked about earlier, which is this movement, the movement of movements, is dead. And a lot of the politics around that no longer have any traction. I mean, that's not surprising. You know, that movement came into being in a very, very different world, like Brian was talking about just then. It came into being at a time where neoliberalism was seen as the answer to the world's problems. You know, there's just nobody who believes that anymore. Or basically, that whole ideology has just got no grip or traction at all. You know what I mean? And like I said, you know, the movements that are sort of like derivative of that, and it took on a lot of the forms of action, the forms of organising from that, such as the Camp for Climate Action, that no longer has traction. And in fact, you know, the Camp for Climate Action has gone through a process of trying to dissolve itself, or perhaps it's just suspending the camp for this year, etc. But if we look at the movements and the sort of struggles that have emerged in response to the crisis, they are also in a state of impasse, I would argue. We've had really big movements occur, like in the Arab Spring, for instance. Really significant movements, like the movement of the indignants in Spain and in Greece. But yet, you know, those events and those movements just haven't been able to cohere in such a way in which they can change the world. They can't cohere into a social force which can actually impact on the world and change the trajectory the world is going in. That's an impasse that we need to overcome. You know, that's I find the present state of politics really frustrating, because you can. You know, the sense of possibility that exists now and over the last couple of years is far bigger than at any point in my political history, which goes back to, well, the late 1980s, or I could even say the miners' strike. Although I was a school kid at the time, I did grow up in a mining town. But that was just a whole period of defeat. All of that. There were a few high points, but you know, there wasn't a sense of political possibility that there is now. But we just can't quite get to it. Do you know what I mean? The whole present seems pregnant with possibility, but we can't actually. It just seems slightly out of grasp. Do you know what I mean? One example of that, I think, or one of the examples of the way that things seem to be possible and we can't quite get there, is the March of 26th march, the big TUC march in London. You know, there's a very big march, and there's some very militant action going on. And yet both of them just followed a script that was pre-existing before the economic crisis, before a new situation came in. It didn't respond to any of these new possibilities that seemed to be there. You know, there's this massive gap between this very passive march, huge but passive march, where, you know, people are fed into a field and then they try to get them out of the other side of the field as quick as possible, get on those coaches, get home. And, you know, quite a big black bloc, which is very militant, but huge separation between that and, like, this huge mass of people. It's a no-brainer. It seems obvious to everyone that gap, that the somehow bridging that gap between, you know, between this militant section here, or, you know, the UK NCAP people who got arrested and fought on the Masons, that gap, to bridge that gap, to pull this mass of people just an inch to the left, or an inch towards more militant action, that is obviously the game. That's the whole, you know, that's obviously the arena, but we haven't been able to find the forms of action or the forms of organising, perhaps, which can get there. And so that's what we want to sort of, like, address. That's the sort of problem that we want to address, really. In a way, we want to sort of, like, try to work out how far these possibilities go. And you can't work that out by doing a survey. You work it out by trying to step out and see what resonates, basically. So we want to follow this line of, like, sorcery, etc. And try to think, well, perhaps one way to think about this when we're trying to come up to get to terms with this and get to terms with our role in this is to think of us as anti-capitalist militants. Well, we certainly are, right? Well, this is just the problem I'm talking to. Us as anti-capitalist militants, I think it may be useful to think of us as also like sorcerers, basically, of some kind. I'm not going to get a big hat out or talk about Harry Potter. But in fact, what we're trying to do is spark something which then takes off and gets out of our control. It's under summoned forces which get beyond us. And in fact, summoned forces that we can't actually know and predict where they're going to go. That's what a social movement is, right? We're trying to summon something up beyond ourselves which can exceed us. And in a way, when we talk about how capitalism sets itself and its dynamics up as just natural, that's just human nature, this is just nature. Well, we're going to try and break what's natural, right? So we're in a way, that means something supernatural. You know, we want to create things which, at the moment, under the natural laws of capitalism, just do not seem possible. Right? This is not, but it's not that we're not talking about something which is, you know, we have to pray to God for. Because we can see that if we just look at Tahrir Square, you know, the fall of Mubarak, thank you. You know, this is something that people wouldn't have predicted the week before. It was something supernatural. The natural progression of things would be a progression from him to his son. Okay, one of the ways we try to think through this is to, for hard materialists like ourselves, to put our neck further out on the line, is to think about the concept of fairy dust. Okay? I find it's always a good for, like, hard Marxists to talk about such concepts. Our way into it is actually via pop culture. We had to retreat back from this and get onto some safe ground for ourselves. Our take on fairy dust comes from the annals of pop history, and it comes from this bootleg tape from the late 60s of the band The Troggs, and of a popular beat combo, Mullud, who did Wild Thing, etc. It's a really famous bootleg tape, basically. It's the Troggs in a recording studio, trying to work out how to get their next hit record. They've had a hit record. How did we do that? How can we get the next hit record? It's a really famous bootleg because it contains lots of swearing in a West Country accent. It's just inherently funny. So it's spread via tapes for a long time now. It's on the internet, etc., etc. But it's also famous because of the punchline, or the conclusion that the Troggs come to after their discussion, which is, you've got to sprinkle a bit of fucking fairy dust all over the bastard. Oh, it's not great. But basically, that's just a fucking funny line. It's great. Or when you hear Reg Presley do it, it's even better. I introduced this concept of, like, we've got to sprinkle some fucking fairy dust over the bastard into sort of our discussions a few years ago. And like anything, you know, it comes to stand in for a whole... Instead of having this whole discussion about, like, the limits of analysis... when you're trying to summon something up beyond yourselves, we just say, let's sprinkle some fairy dust on the bastard. And then we recently read this book called Capitalist Sorcery, which is trying to take... which is like by a philosopher called Isabel Stengers, who's like a philosopher of science, a fairly hard materialist, and she's trying to take seriously some sort of like magical practices of people like Starhawk, who were like these Wiccan sort of pagan witches, were very involved in introducing things like consensus decision making into the movement. All right, it's a bit of a digression. But when I read that book, I thought, oh, perhaps we could think a little bit more seriously about this fairy dust while retaining the Troggs as our point of reference. One of the reasons I like it is because it introduces a sort of level of humility into politics. Do you know what I mean? There's only a... You could, you know, you can only analyse so far. Eventually you have to try things out, right? And if those things resonate and they take off beyond what you could imagine, then they work. Do you know what I mean? There's a certain limit point to analysis. So in fact, there's a limit point to what we can do. So there's a certain level of humility there. And if we translate, like, the fairy dust of... If we translate that fairy dust anecdote into politics, it's like, what's the equivalent of, like, this next hit record? I might read that out. It's the equivalent of something like finding the slogan or the demand or the form of action or the form of organisation, which is going to resonate with people, which can then take off and, like, move in ways which you wouldn't have predicted beforehand. So fairy dust is that idea that you need to, you know, politics is a roll of the dice, it's a gamble, you need to try stuff out, you need to experiment with stuff and see what works. But it's not just blind luck, right? It's chance, but it's not just blind luck. And let's go back to the Trogs tape. At a certain point, they're having this massive argument, they're all swearing, nearly fighting, and then somebody goes, I know what it needs, let's need some fucking strings, get some strings on this bastard. So they're looking at past experience, right? They're saying, look, strings worked on this last record. We could try that. Let's bring that into our invocation of fairy dust. Do you know what I mean? There's a danger there, right? Is that, you know, they may have just fallen into cliche, right? And in fact, strings is not appropriate. But it is that idea that, you know, you're trying to summon something up. You do look at your past experiences, but you're in a new situation, so you don't know whether it's going to work. So let's think about, I want to just think about N by thinking about, like, what, if we were going to try to design some sort of incantation which gives the best chance of summoning up a bit of politics in the present situation, what would it look like, basically? And to think about that, I want to start with, like, the UK Uncut actions. Because that is an example of, you know, a small group of people, actually, you know, working out a form of action which then resonated, took off virally, and people just took it as their own and did it themselves. You know, and it's pretty odd that, a form of action based around tax avoidance would take off, would capture people's imagination. Now, you wouldn't have necessarily predicted that. There is a degree of luck in there, in this. From what I can understand, the original UK Uncut action, the first one, was going to be an occupation. It was basically following the experience of climate camps. They're going to go to the headquarters of Vodafone and occupy the headquarters of Vodafone. But they hadn't done the research. They hadn't realised that the headquarters of Vodafone had moved out of London. So they go, oh shit, what are we going to do? Let's occupy a store. Let's occupy the store in Oxford Street. Luckily, that twist of luck was like the bit that was the genius, because then that means it could be picked up and followed, you know, whereas, you know, there's only one HQ, etc. Okay, so UK Uncut's invocation involves certain number of elements, right? One of them is it gives expression to something which is in the air, and which became obvious with the student movement, which is there's a much more widespread desire to go beyond politics as usual, right? In the student movement, you could see that because it was just blatantly obvious you couldn't vote yourself out of the situation. Well, we can't vote ourselves out of the situation we're in. You know, oh yeah, we just voted for the Liberal Democrats. They promised not to raise fees. Now they've tripled them. Right, okay, I can. There's a sort of there's an extra parliamentary logic, therefore, to this situation. There's no one to vote for, therefore, there's an extra parliamentary logic. But UK Uncut a form of expressing this mood, this anti-parliamentary mood, was probably more successful than a form of action which expressed it in a more militant way. Right, and that's partly because their form of action was really easily replicable. Replicable. Unlike that word, it's just very hard to repeat. it involved moving outside of politics as normal, but it involved doing it in such a way which it wasn't too much of a risk. It wasn't too much of a jump, if you know. You weren't risking too much. You didn't involve too much organisation. It was easy, you know, there was lots of things which were easily replicable about it. It was easy to repeat. It didn't involve specialist knowledge. Like a lot of the forms of direct action in small groups that people have done before, you know, that they miss this thing. And in fact, there's a bit of a tendency to sort of glorify in the difficultness, the non-replicability of of actions. The second part of the incantation of UK Uncut, which I think made it work, was that the action contained an argument, and the argument was quite easy to grasp from that form of action. So basically, we're going to occupy the banks as a, you know, to protest against tax evasion. And this reveals that austerity, the decision to implement austerity, is a political decision. So it's that thing of like revealing politics behind, you know, politics is always hidden. There's never a political decision. It's always, this is just the way things are. This is just material fact. We have to impose austerity. There's no other option. Well, you know, well, in fact, look, if we taxed corporations and the rich to the same extent that they taxed the rest of us, we'd raise this much money. This would cover this, right? It made sense. It's an obvious, you know, it makes sense straight away. And also in a way that, in that form of action, in particular, the response that it provokes from, you know, politicians and from the police, it also reveals something about neoliberalism, which is also hidden, which is the idea that, you know, society is antagonistic, is that there are different interests in society, and like the police, politicians line up alongside certain interests, and they don't line up again with other interests. So certain laws are followed. Certain investigations are followed. 200 police are assigned to track down student protesters, and yet we can't quite look into this dossier of files for News International. You know, it reveals something about which is hidden in neoliberalism. So neoliberalism always said there is no politics here. We're all on the same side. We're all in together, etc., etc. You know the lines. But there's a danger in that, right? The danger is, because things have got to be easily understandable, they have to be within the... You can only push so far into the boundaries of what is thinkable or sayable in our society. You know, you have to start from within. In order to make an argument instantly understandable, you have to start within a lot of the presuppositions and the assumptions, you know, which come before thinking in our society. And I think that raises... another problem, which is, or another third element in a way, that we need to involve in our incantations of politics, right? If our actions don't involve forms where we can analyse and adapt and change and push further into the limiting of our lives and the sort of sense of society as it is now, we don't have form. If our forms of action don't involve mechanisms in which we can do that, then the danger is we just collapse back into the sense of the old society. And that's sort of what's happened with UK and CUT. You know, so basically, they've ended up on the territory of arguing about tax evasion, and you know, basically, this hiding of political decision comes along, you know, straight away. So, the response to UK and CUT is, we'd love to tax the bankers. Of course, we'd love to tax them. If we did, they'd just move to Geneva. We have no option. There is no political decision. There is no politics here. That's sort of like the collapse. And in order to avoid that, you have to push further. So that's the third element. I'm going to. Stopson. That's the third element that we need to, when we try to think of like the incantations of summing up some politics at this, in the present moment, that's the third element, I think. These actions, or these forms of actions, these forms of organisation need to involve some form of collective analysis in a way. Okay. So the politics of our present time needs to involve action and confrontation with existing society. Those things tend to be quite intense, quite, you know, involve a high level of intensity, and those high level situations of high levels of intensity are not situations in which you can analyse and collectively and, you know, push further. So we need to build in some spaces into these incantations in which we can do that. And I think if you look at the student occupations, they fulfilled that role for a certain period. People would go out on actions, go out on demonstrations, and they'd come back to the student occupations, and then you'd discuss them. You know, and there'd be a process of collective political education, and that meant that you could then adapt and change quite quickly. So during the student movement in November in London, you know, the problem of Ketlin came up, and it was, you know, in that case, we keep moving, etc. New things could be tried out each week. We need to sort of summon up those, involve those. And just to explain the logic of that, let's just turn to one last magical analogy. It's a bit like, you know, if you get the lamp and you rub the lamp and a genie comes out, okay, it gives you three wishes, right? And so, like, the trick with that is always, of course, your last wish is to ask for another three wishes, right? That's the analogy with, like, having a collective analysis. You know, that's the only way in which a movement can escape the conditions of its own emergence, push out and generalise, and get control over the ability to grant our own wishes. Yes, let's leave it there.